Scott Hansen. I represent Jeffrey Lynn Curtley, who was in front of the trial court in Harrisonburg, Virginia, for a violation of the probation violation. I would assert from the outset that the trial court weighed the right factors but committed a clear error of judgment when it abused its discretion to violate Mr. Curtley because, as the fact in the record demonstrates, there were, one, no new violations of law. Two, Mr. Curtley kept all appointments with his probation officer. Three, there were no positive tests for drugs or alcohol. Four, Mr. Curtley maintained his employment. Five, he was compliant to the extent that he could be with the sex offender assessment. To that extent, he took and successful. He took both the test for the RAZR, which is a test to determine recidivism, and scored the lowest that he could, a 1 out of 12. He also took the static 99 test, another assessment, where he scored a low risk, and he did in fact submit to a polygraph test. In this circumstance, what I see here...
The polygraph test results, to the extent the record reflects them, were not entirely positive towards him, or were they?
They were not, but and again, what I have a major concern is the court's even awareness of that. We have the Turner case, which I raised to the court.
You just brought it up.
I understand that.
In your favor, an argument. So
I understand that,
sir.
You're
not aware of it.
I know that, and I can. It's one of those situations, sir, where once that barn door has been opened, there's really nothing that I can do.
Why don't you simply disregard the polygraph then? And
okay, absolutely. I think that would be appropriate to do so. That being said, sir, what we have is a circumstance where this gentleman was convicted of a statute that was 40.1-103. This is in the child labor statute or section, health and human welfare, that deals with the issue of essentially having children in circumstances that would be unhealthy for them. And this is also a non-registry offense. This was an Alford plea that he entered into. So what we have here is an individual who entered an Alford plea to a non-sex offense, to a non-sex registry offense, and essentially complied with all of the requirements, with the exception that he was unable to say what I've described in the brief, the magic words to his assessor, who was Miss Vicki Cashgraf with the Shenandoah Valley Sex Offender Treatment Program. He was unwilling to admit that he had touched the bare breast of a young lady.
Counsel, I've had some difficulty with your assertion in your brief that he was unwilling to assert that he had touched the bare breast of the young lady. What he was actually asked to admit was that touching a bra with a breast in it was touching the breast. That was actually what he was asked to admit, was it not?
My recollection, ma'am, was that because he was unwilling to say that it was a bare breast or that touching a bra-covered breast was the same thing as touching a breast, that was essentially the admission that he was unable to make.
Page 21 of the memorandum from the licensed clinical social worker. He acknowledges that the bra was on her when he touched it, but will not admit touching her breast. I have attempted to assist Mr. Curtley in working through his denial by pointing out that he obviously touched her breast if the bra was on her body, covering her breast when he touched the bra. And that was what he was unwilling to admit.
That is correct, ma'am. And I think that I bring that to light in the brief itself, where I discuss that there is this very important, at least for my client, semantic difference. And I think that clarity is what is where the impasse lies.
And that was the problem, that was the reason that he was violated and returned, because the social worker's position was that he was in denial because there is no difference between touching a breast with a bra on it and touching a bra with a breast in it.
I would venture to say that there is a very distinct difference between touching a bra-covered breast and a non-bra-covered breast. I know it sounds pedantic, but I believe there is a distinct difference, ma'am.
She was, well, I've read to you what she said. She wasn't trying to get him to say, I touched a bare breast.
Understood.
Trying to get him to say, I touched a breast with a bra on it.
Counsel.
Yes, sir.
Day before yesterday was the coldest day in 20 years.
Yes, sir.
I saw you on the sidewalk in Harrisonburg and said hello and gave you the usual greeting. Would I have shaken your glove or shaken your hand?
Yesterday, sir, you would have shaken my glove with my hand in it.
Thank you, counsel.
Let me ask another question. These courts specifically ordered your client to undergo sex offender treatment. Did your client ever ask to withdraw his guilty plea after he was sentenced with that specific condition in his sentence?
I cannot speak to that, ma'am. I did not represent him on the underlying offense, and I simply, I'm not privy to the conversations that he had with his trial counsel and how they have worked that resolution out, so I simply can't speak to that, ma'am.
Let me follow up on Justice Powell's question, because that's exactly the question I have. It seems to me that you're arguing that he didn't violate the condition of probation, but what I think you're really talking about is that that was an unfair condition of probation to put him on sex offender treatment based upon the offense with which he was, of which he was convicted. But that is not your challenge on to us, and that was not ever challenged to the trial court, was it?
That is correct. And I want to let the court know is that I'm not objecting to, because it's moot. It's moot for me. It's moot for Mr. Kirtley. Is the whether or not the court had the authority to place him on or require that he complete this. That's not the question before the court today. The question before the court today is simply this. Did the court abuse its discretion in finding that there was, because of his failure to complete the sex offender treatment by the evidence that we have in front of us,
right,
if that was an abuse of discretion?
Okay, why was it an abuse?
I argue that is it was an abuse because of all of the factors that we've got regarding Mr. Kirtley's good behavior. The fact that he actually went through the program. The fact that the very...
Tell me the facts. Tell me the legal analysis. What's the legal analysis that makes this an abuse of discretion or not an abuse of discretion, if you can
sure.
do that?
Sure. It simply comes down to, if we look to the Lawler case in particular, where it outlines and adopts the language of the Landrum case, there are three basic primary places where we can look and see abuse of discretion. One is if the court looks at relevant material and doesn't give them the proper weight. Second, if it looks at irrelevant material and gives it weight. And the third is if it basically looks at the correct factors and then makes an incorrect judgment.
Okay, now apply that to your facts here.
And I'm saying that the court here, when it looks at these facts, came to an incorrect judgment.
Why?
Because ultimately we get to a subjective level, and I'm afraid that's where we're at, where if you look at everything that Mr. Kirtley had done successfully, he had complied with everything they had requested. The only thing he was unwilling or unable to do was give them that recitation.
Well, isn't that part of a judge's discretion? That happens all the time in revocation hearings. I did 100 things right, I did one thing wrong, and the judge violates me. Every time that happens, I can say, Judge, you abuse your discretion?
I suppose what I see happening here, too, though, is there is almost a diminution of authority from the court by giving authority to what I would describe as non-court actors. What we have here is an individual who is a sex offender treatment provider who is now standing in that place of judgment in lieu of the court.
Is that true? The treatment provider is just bringing evidence, information, to the court. They're bringing the facts to the court, and they're saying he did this, but he didn't do this. I'm returning him, Judge, for you to decide whether he should be violated.
I guess what I would bring my response to that is there is, when they trip that wire, when they call that, if you will, if they call that card and say, you're going back because you haven't, according to me, successfully completed the program. What they're doing is essentially creating, they are becoming very important actors making decisions for individuals' liberty that is extrajudicial.
Well, see, I don't know that that is necessarily a problem, that the court would rely upon experts about somebody completing treatment properly. Isn't the problem here I would think, your best argument that the court shouldn't revoke someone's probation based upon their failure to agree with the factual conclusion of a treatment provider. It's like, you did everything that I wanted you to do, but I wanted you to say the floor is the ceiling, and you won't say that. Say the floor is the ceiling. If you don't, if you will never say that, then I will never pass you in this treatment. And the person is saying, it's just not true. You want me to say something that's not true, that I don't believe? And they're basically saying, that's what you got to do if you want to stay out of prison. You got to say that's true. Because I said that's what you've got to do in order to get out of this.
And I think you said it more eloquently than I have said it, or I've tried to say it. That's exactly what I'm getting. That's the issue here, is ultimately you've got someone. Someone can look and say he's in denial.
But, counsel, that's not the issue. You make the issue, did he admit to touching the breast, or did he admit to touching the bra covering the breast?
Understood, sir.
Which is a false distinction, because the Ms. Popotnick's report, I'm looking at page 2 of the joint appendix. The conclusion was his adjustment was poor. Now, why was his adjustment poor? It was because Ms. Cash Graff said Kirtley was telling Group he didn't understand why he was there, because he wasn't convicted of a sex offense. He was also telling Group that he didn't know what was in his plea agreement. He was just told to sign it. He signed a plea agreement. He agreed, you will submit to this sort of treatment if it is recommended. And it was. And he went to the group, and he denied that he had any sort of a problem. It wasn't a matter of denying the very specific allegation about bra versus breast. Rather, it was denying, I shouldn't even be here. I didn't commit a sex offense. I don't even know what I signed. How can you successfully complete a program when that is your mindset? That's the violation that brought him back into court, not a very specific fact of exactly what did you touch.
I guess my understanding is that the Commonwealth said in their brief he was terminated from sex offender treatment for failing to admit his crime. That's the reason. It was my understanding that was accepted by everyone as the reason for his termination. Was that one thing, failing to admit this particular fact?
And if I could bring to the justice's attention, on page 35 of that same appendix, we have cross-examination by myself of Mrs., if I'm not mistaken, it was Ms. Popotnick. Mr. Kirtley was, and if I may, Mr. Kirtley was convicted of the offense. What offense, ma'am? He was convicted of child neglect. Okay, and do you have notes from Ms. Cashgraff? Have you spoken to Ms. Cashgraff? Have you seen anything in the report from Ms. Cashgraff that says he did not admit to that offense? The offense of child neglect? Yes. No. Okay, so the offense that he was convicted of was child neglect, and you've got nothing from his cash graph that says he didn't say, I didn't do that. Nothing that said he did not commit child neglect. Right. Is that correct? Yes. He admitted to the offense to which he pled guilty. And ultimately, that was not good enough for his counselor, who then brought that to the attention of the court, who then violated it.
Is there a difference between the offense and the offense for which he pled guilty and the crime for which he was convicted? The offense for which he pled guilty was the touching of the breast. That language is different from the language in Carroll, where Carroll was asked to admit guilt to the crime of rape. The crime of rape with which he had been charged, the crime of rape with which he had been charged, as opposed to the offense here, the acts that underlie whatever crime you were convicted of under the plea agreement.
Could you help me distill that question, ma'am?
Is there a difference between the offense and the crime for which he was convicted, the offense being the underlying fact?
If you're asking me whether or not the statute covered the behavior...
No, I'm not asking you that. I'm asking the terminology. You're asking the witness whether he admitted to the offense. Is that the same as asking if he admitted to the crime for which he was convicted?
Ooh, that's a great semantic distinction. I'm not sure I can answer that. I can tell you that he ascribed or said that he owned what he did. That is, he owned the offense. And now I've exceeded my time, but what I'm saying is he owned his offense.
But that's the problem. He didn't own the offense. But you've answered my question.
Yes,
thank
ma'am.
You.
I think that's where the rub lies.
Thank you.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you.
Your Honors, may it please the Court. I'm Susan Baumgartner for the Office of the Attorney General. There's been a lot of talk about semantics in this case, and I think we need to go back to what happened, as unseemly as it was. The defendant took his seventh-grade stepdaughter shopping. On the way home in the car, he ordered her to take off her shirt and try on a bra. She was crying. She tried to crawl into the back seat to get away from him, and he ordered her to do it. She did. He reached out, fondled her, and he only stopped when another car pulled up. And then, once that car left, he asked her if he could do it again. That is what underlies the charges in this case. After being indicted for indecent liberties and aggravated sexual battery, he got a misdemeanor plea that meant he only had to do 20 days in jail. He didn't have to register as a sex offender. He did have to go to sex offender treatment, and he complained every step of the way.
Well, let me stop you right there. You talked about the incident that happened between he and his stepdaughter, but wasn't his view of the facts different from what you just recited?
His view of the facts is that there was a little bit of a difference over why he ordered her to try on the bra, but he admitted that he ordered her to take off her shirt and try on a bra in the car, and that he touched her. But he said he just reached out and touched her, and there wasn't any sustained fondling, and that he did it once she had the bra on as opposed to when she was completely bare. That's the difference.
Okay.
And once he got to sex offender treatment, it wasn't merely whether or not he admitted that she was completely bare. It was that he said it wasn't sexual, that he said there was no denial in his life, that he was never going to change his mind or his statement, that he was at no risk of reoffending. He didn't do his homework. He was judgmental and inappropriate in group. And for all those reasons, he was thrown out of sex offender treatment. This is not about someone who was thrown out for some semantic reason.
Let me stop you right there, because I think, to me, that's so important in this case, is exactly why he was terminated. And my understanding is that it was agreed that he was terminated for failing to admit to his crime. It wasn't because, you know, he didn't do his homework. It wasn't because he, you know, didn't want to be there. All those things were not the reason why he was terminated. And on page 13 of your brief, mm-hmm. you say he was terminated from sex offender treatment for failing to admit his crime. I mean, to me, it's a big difference between whether he was only terminated because he wouldn't admit to a particular fact, as opposed to he was terminated because he was recalcitrant and wouldn't do what people wanted him to do.
Well, Your Honor, if you, that is part of the reason he was terminated. That's not the entirety. To quote the sex offender treatment, she said he insists on attributing it to a dumb move on his part rather than fondling and molesting a child. He refused to admit to what his actions meant. The entire reason he was allowed to take a plea, the entire idea behind suspended sentences, is remedial. He was allowed to get a great deal predicated on his attempting to process his crime in a therapeutic environment as remediation to prevent him from doing it again. And he refused to engage in that process at all. Your Honor, once again, this is also, it's an abuse of discretion case. This has been conceded, and the trial court can revoke the sentence for any cause the court deems sufficient. Once again, because its purpose is remedial, that's why there is such broad discretion. And here, the trial court didn't abuse its discretion. The suspension was predicated on cooperating with probation, which the sentencing order explicitly included that he may face sex offender treatment. Now, while he's arguing that he tested as low risk is not the same as no risk. Is this in the realm of possible sex offenses the worst possible crime? Absolutely not. Does that mean for his seventh grade victim, the 14-year-old, it didn't matter? No. And for the same reason, no risk is not the same as low risk. If you read the report, as I talk about in my brief, he was still involved with this family. He was still involved with his wife. He was still involved with this child. And that was part of their concern. They were concerned that he would reoffend.
Counsel.
Yes.
Looking at page 67 of the Joint Appendix, the final order that that effectuated the plea agreement required him to enter into and successfully complete all counseling programs. Is it possible for one to successfully complete a counseling program when one denies all of the foundational facts that brought one into the program?
I don't believe it is, and I think Ms. Graff's report makes that clear, that the basis of sex offender treatment involves admitting what you've done, recognizing its effect on other people.
And ultimately, we're here because he didn't successfully complete the program.
Right. And he didn't, it's not a matter of merely he didn't successfully complete it. He didn't even really try. He got thrown out after the second time he had to meet because they decided, since he was so insistent that nothing was going to change, he had nothing to contribute, he did not belong there, that they felt he was not ever going to successfully complete.
So why didn't they just say that? I mean, I guess that's the thing that trips me. It seems like to me it would be easy to say that he, you know, was not a good candidate for this because he was recalcitrant and he wouldn't do what they say and he didn't do his homework. But they don't say that. They say that the reason why he was terminated was because he continues to deny his offense.
Well,
I mean, you know, to me that's, I can't help but tell you again, to me that's a big difference. It's a big difference between, you know, going there and you know, not participating and not trying, as opposed to going there doing everything that people ask you to do, but then they ask you to admit to a fact that you don't believe is true, and you say, well, no, I'm not going to admit to that.
Well, Your Honor, Ms. Cashgraf's report in this is fairly lengthy, and she talks about on page 13 of the record, he significantly minimizes his offense. He acknowledges that it occurred but continues to deny that it was sexual in nature. He chooses to attribute it to a dumb move on his part rather than fondling and molesting a child. He needs to be more accountable regarding his actions and motivations behind his behaviors. There is, within the multiple treatment and progress reports that are part of the record, there are multiple comments by Ms. Cashgraf and by his probation officer about how he is not participating. And she talks about the goals being that he needs to accept responsibility.
So you're saying this is not even a Carroll-type case. It's not even a Carroll-type case. It really doesn't have anything to do with him admitting or not admitting a particular fact. It has to do with his failure to follow the directions or be amenable to the treatment, period.
Correct. It's not. It is partially that he would not admit the fact, that he would not acknowledge that there was a connection between touching his stepdaughter's bra while she was wearing it and touching her breast. That's part of it, but there's more than merely refusing to admit the crime.
Okay. I mean, to me it seems like, I don't know whether it's been served up to us in that way. I mean, do you think that's what the Court of Appeals was talking about? I mean, that it was like a more general failure to be amenable to treatment as opposed to failing to admit to a fact.
What the Court of Appeals was talking about, in which case, Your Honor?
This case.
The Court of Appeals did not accept the petition for appeal in this case.
Well, I guess there was, I know I saw some document from the Court of Appeals that discussed it. Maybe you don't have it, but okay. All right.
So, Your Honor, the real issue before the court, because he never did make any effort to...
I'm sorry. What I was talking about, there's a per curiam order from the Court of Appeals, I mean, concerning this matter. I didn't think I would have something that was not a public record that I read from the Court of Appeals, but don't worry about that.
Yes. Well, ultimately, the Court of Appeals did find that the trial court simply didn't err in finding that he had violated the terms and conditions of his probation. It's pretty simple. He was ordered to go to sex offender treatment. He was ordered to successfully complete it, and he did not do so. And this was already brought up. He never saw it when he was part of his plea agreement that he had to fulfill any treatment, or his sentencing order that said specifically he'd have to fulfill sex offender treatment if he was ordered to. He never sought to appeal that in any way. He did, when he was originally ordered to go in for evaluation, say, I don't want to go. And at that point, his probation officer, if you read the report in the record, considered violating him and called up the Commonwealth's attorney, who said, don't worry about it, I'll talk to his attorney. And apparently, after a conversation with his defense attorney,
we all agree on all those facts.
So,
and just to me, the whole thing comes down to, why was he violated?
Well,
yeah, that's where the rubber meets the road.
Right. At any of those points, Your Honor, though, I think he could have attacked whether it was a reasonable condition. And ultimately, what the defense argument comes down to is that it was not a reasonable condition.
Hold up a second.
So therefore,
hold
he didn't
up a second.
Have to follow
hold
it.
Hold up a second. It's my understanding counsel has conceded it was a reasonable condition for him to go to sex offender treatment. Nobody disputes that.
Well, if it's a reasonable condition for him to go to sex offender treatment, then he either completes it or he doesn't. It's binary.
So no matter what they ask him to do, he's just got to do it.
Well, Your Honor, sex offender treatment, it's not as though it's set up in a vacuum by people who aren't trained for it. Ms. Cash Graff was a licensed social worker. She was a certified sex offender treatment professional. There are theories and goals and practices behind sex offender treatment, and he wasn't asked to do anything unreasonable. He was asked to participate in the remedial process, to participate in the treatment process, and he simply would not acknowledge that he did anything wrong. He clings to this idea that because he was convicted of a statute that is colloquially known as neglect, child neglect, that therefore a sex offense is not encompassed in that. But in fact, the statute involves willfully causing and permitting the health of such a child to be injured, or causing or permitting such a child to be cruelly treated. His actions in this case were cruel treatment of a child. There's no question about that. Now, aggravated sexual battery may be a more specific cruel treatment, but his actions in this case were cruel treatment of a child, and he refused to acknowledge anything but it was a stupid thing he did, and he didn't need to look into it any further. And for all those reasons, he was violated from sex offender treatment. If there are no further questions, I ask you to affirm.
All right, thank you. Call the next case, please.